I don't remember his ever doing much else until he started working for Dad. He pumped gas for a while, so I suppose he might have become a career gas station attendant. What kind of car did he drive? He drove the family Chevy until he was involved in a hit-and-run accident and his license was suspended. After that, Dad refused to let him use any of the family vehicles.
Do you know if his license was ever reinstated?
If it wasn't, he probably drove without. He never cared much about life's petty little rules and regulations.
Did he have any hobbies?
Not unless you count smoking dope and getting laid.
What about his personal interests? Did he hunt or fish? Did he skydive? I was floundering, casting about in an attempt to develop a sense of direction. Bennett shook his head.
He was a vegetarian. He said nothing should ever have to die so that he could eat. He was petrified of heights, so I doubt he ever jumped out of airplanes, or climbed mountains, or bungee-jumped.
Well, at least we can eliminate that, I said. Did he have medical problems?
Medical problems? Like what?
I don't know. I'm just trying to find ways to get a bead on him. Was he diabetic? Did he have allergies or any chronic illnesses?
Oh, I see what you're getting at. No. As far as I know, his health was good. For someone so heavily into drink and drugs.
Donovan says he had one good friend, somebody named Paul.
You're talking about Paul Trasati. I can give you his telephone number. He hasn't gone anywhere.
I'd appreciate that. He recited the number off the top of his head, and I made a quick note in the little spiral-bound notebook I carry. I tried to think about the areas I hadn't covered yet. Was he a draft dodger? Did he protest the war in Vietnam?
He didn't have to. The army wouldn't take him. He had bad feet. Lucky him. He never gave a shit about politics. He never even voted, as far as I know.
What about religion? Did he do yoga, meditate, chant, walk on hot coals? This was like pulling teeth. He shook his head again.
None of the above.
What about bank accounts?
Nope. At least he didn't have any back then.
Did he own any stocks or bonds? Bennett shook his head again. He was beginning to seem amused at my persistence, which I found irritating.
He must have cared about something, I said.
He was a fuck-up, pure and simple. He never lifted a finger for anyone except himself. Typical narcissist. The girls couldn't get enough of him. You figure it out.
Look, Bennett, I understand your hostility, but I can do without the editorializing. You must have cared about him once.
Of course,
he said blandly, averting his gaze.
But that was before he became such a pain in the ass to all of us. Besides, he's been gone for years. I suppose at some level I have some kind of family feeling, but it's hard to sustain given his long absence.
Once he left, none of you ever heard from him? His eyes came back to mine.
I can only speak for myself. He never called me or wrote. If he was in touch with anyone else, I wasn't told about it. Maybe Paul knows something.
What sort of work does he do?
He's a rare book dealer. He buys and sells autographs, letters, manuscripts, things like that.
He closed his mouth and smiled faintly, volunteering nothing unless I asked point blank. I wasn't getting anywhere, and it was probably time to move on.
What about Jack? Could Guy have confided in him?
You can ask him yourself. He's right out there,
Bennett said. He gestured toward the windows, and I followed his gaze. I caught a glimpse of Jack as he crossed the back lawn, heading away from the house toward a slope to the left. The rear of the property picked up just enough sun to foster a mix of coarse, patchy grasses, some of which were dormant at this time of year. He had a couple of golf clubs tucked carelessly under one arm, and he carried a bucket and a net in a blue plastic frame. By the time we caught up with him and Bennett had introduced us, Jack was using a sand wedge to smack golf balls at the net he'd set up 20 yards away.
End of disc one. Disc two.
By the time we caught up with him and Bennett had introduced us, Jack was using a sand wedge to smack golf balls at the net he'd set up 20 yards away. Bennett withdrew and left me to watch Jack practicing his chipping shots. He'd swing, and I could hear the thin whistle as the club cut through the air. There'd be a whack, and then the ball would arc toward the net with an unerring accuracy. Occasionally, a shot would hit the grass nearby, landing with a short bounce, but most of the time he nailed the target he was aiming for. He wore a visor with Pebble Beach imprinted on the rim. His hair was light brown, a shock of it protruding from the Velcro-secured opening at the back. He wore chinos and a golf shirt with the emblem for St. Andrews stitched on the front like a badge. He was leaner than his two brothers, and his face and arms were tanned. I could see him measure the trajectory of the bull as it sailed through the air. He said,
"I hope this doesn't seem rude, but I've got a tournament coming up."
I murmured politely, not wanting to break his concentration. Whistle. Whack.
"You've been hired to find Guy," he said when the ball landed.
He frowned to himself and adjusted his stance.
"How's it coming?"
I smiled briefly. "So far, all I have are his date of birth and his social security number."
"Why did Donovan tell you to talk to me?"
"Why wouldn't I talk to you?" He ignored me for the moment. I watched as he walked out to the net and leaned down, gathering the countless bulls, which he tossed in his plastic bucket. He came back to the spot where I was standing and started all over again. His swing looked exactly the same, time after time, without variation. Swing, whack, in the net. He'd put the next ball down. Swing, whack, in the net. He shook his head at one shot, responding to my comment belatedly.
"Donovan doesn't have much use for me. He's a Puritan at heart. It's all work, work, work with him. You have to be productive, get the job done. All that rah, rah, rah stuff. As far as he's concerned, golf isn't worthy of serious consideration unless it nets you an annual income of $500,000.
He paused to look at me, leaning lightly on his golf club as if it were a cane.
"I don't have any idea where Guy went, if that's what you're here to ask. I was finishing my senior year at Wake Forest, so I heard about it by phone. Dad called and said he'd told Guy to hit the road. They'd had a quarrel about something, and off he went."
"When was the last time you saw him?"
"When I was home for Mother's funeral in January. When I came home again for spring break, he'd been gone maybe 3 days. I figured the whole thing would blow over, but it never did. By the time I graduated and came home in June, the subject was never mentioned."
"It's not like we were forbidden to refer to him. We just didn't, I guess, out of consideration for Dad."
"You never heard from Guy at all? Not a call or a postcard in all these years?" Jack shook his head. "Didn't that bother you?"
"Of course. I adored him. I saw him as a rebel, a true individual. I hated school and I was miserable. I did poorly in most classes. All I wanted was to play golf, and I didn't see why I had to have a college education. I would have gone off with Guy in a heartbeat if he'd told me what was going on. What can I tell you? He never called. He never wrote. He never gave any indication he gave a shit about me. Such is life."
"And nobody outside the family ever reported running into him?"
"Like at a convention or something? You're really scraping the bottom of the barrel on that one."
"You think you'd have heard something."
"Why? I mean, what's the big deal? People probably pull this shit all the time. Go off and nobody ever hears from them again. There's no law says you have to stay in touch with people just because you're related."
"Well, true," I said, thinking of my own avoidance of relatives. "Do you know of anyone else who might help? Did he have a girlfriend?" Jack smiled mockingly.
"Guy was the kind of fellow mothers warned their little girls about."
"Donovan told me women found him attractive, but I don't get it. What was the appeal?"
"They weren't women, they were girls. Melodrama is seductive when you're 17.
I thought about it briefly, but this seemed like another dead end.
"Well, if you have any ideas, could you get in touch?"
I took a card from my handbag and passed it over to him. Jack glanced at my name.
"How's the last name pronounced?"
"Milhone," I said. "Accent on the first syllable, the last rhymes with bone." He nodded.
"Fair enough. You won't hear from me, of course, but at least you can say you tried."
He smiled.
"I'm sure Don was way too cool to mention this," he said mildly. "But we're all hoping you won't find him. That way we can file a petition asking the court to declare him dead
and his share can be divided among the three of us.
That's what diligent search is all about, isn't it? Tell Donovan I'll call him in a day or two, I said.
I walked back across the grass toward the house.
What a bunch, I thought.
Behind me, I could hear the whistle of Jack's swing and the sound of the club head on impact.
I could have knocked at the front door again and asked the housekeeper if Donovan's wife, Christy, was at home. As an old college chum of Tasha's, she might at least be gracious. On the other hand, she wasn't married to Donovan at the point when Guy departed, and I couldn't believe she'd have anything of substance to contribute. So, where did that leave me? I got in my car and started the engine, shifting into first. I eased down the long drive toward the street beyond. At the front gate, I paused, shifting into neutral and letting the car idle while I considered the possibilities. As nearly as I could tell, Guy Malik hadn't been a property owner in Santa Teresa County, so there wasn't any point in checking the tax rolls or real property records. From what his brothers had indicated, he'd never even rented his own apartment, which meant I couldn't consult with a past landlord or query the water, gas, electric, or phone companies for a forwarding address. Most of those records aren't kept for 18 years anyway. What else? At the time he'd left Santa Teresa, he had no job and no significant employment history, so there wasn't any point in checking with the local labor unions or with Social Security. He didn't vote, own a car, or a gun, didn't hunt or fish, which probably meant he didn't have any permits or licenses on record. He'd probably acquired a driver's license and a vehicle by now. Also, using past behavior as a future indicator, he probably had a criminal history in the system somewhere, certainly with the National Crime Information Center. Unfortunately, I didn't have access to that information, and offhand, I couldn't think of anyone who'd be willing to run a computer check. A law enforcement officer with proper authorization has all sorts of databases available that I couldn't tap into as a licensed private eye. I put the VW in first gear, hung a left, and drove over to the Department of Motor Vehicles. It was just shy of closing time, and the place was clearing out. I filled out a form asking for a record search. Often DMV records will be out of date. People move, but the change of address won't show up in the DMV computers until a driver's license or a vehicle registration is renewed. In this case, if Guy Malik had left the state, all the data might well be years out of date, if it showed up at all. At the moment, however, it seemed like the quickest way to get a preliminary fix on the situation. Since I didn't have his driver's license number, I picked up an ANI multiple record request form, filling in his full name and date of birth. The automated name index file would either show no record for the criteria given, or would show a match for last name, first name, middle initial, and birth date. As soon as I got back to the office, I'd put the form in the mail and ship it off to Sacramento. With luck, I could at least pick up his mailing address. In the meantime, since the office was nearly empty, I asked one of the DMV clerks to check the name through her computer. She turned and gave me her full attention.
"Are you nuts? I could get fired for doing that," she said.
She turned the monitor on its swivel so I couldn't peek at the screen.
"I'm a PI," I said.
"You could be the Pope for all I care. You'll have to wait to hear from Sacramento. You get nothing from me."
"It was worth a try," I said. I tried a winsome smile, but it didn't get me far.
"You got a nerve," she said.
She turned away with a reproving shake of her head and began to pack away her desk.
So much for my powers of persuasion.
Chapter 4. I returned to the office, typed up the envelope, wrote a check to the state, attached it to the form, affixed a stamp, and stuck the packet in the box for outgoing mail. Then I picked up the phone and called Darcy Pasco, the secretary receptionist at California Fidelity Insurance. We chatted briefly about the old days, and I caught up on minor matters before making the same request to her that I'd made to the DMV clerk. Insurance companies are always running DMV checks. Darcy wasn't actually authorized to inquire, but she knew how to bend the rules with the best of them. I said, "All I need is a mailing address."
"What's your time frame?"
"I don't know. How about first thing tomorrow?"
"I can probably do that. But it'll cost you. What's this kid's name again?
When I got home, lights were on in the apartment, but Dietz was still out someplace. He'd brought in a soft-sided suitcase that he'd placed beside the couch. A quick check in the closet showed a hanging garment bag. In the downstairs bathroom, his dop kit was sitting on the lid to the toilet tank. The room smelled of soap, and there was a damp towel hung across the shower rod. I went back to the kitchen and turned on the radio. Elvis was singing the final chorus of Can't Help Falling in Love. Spare me, I said crossly, and turned the thing off. I went up the spiral stairs to the loft, where I kicked off my Reeboks and stretched out on the bed. I stared up at the skylight. It was well after 5 o'clock, and the dark had fallen on us like a wool blanket, a dense leaden gray. Through the plexiglass dome, I couldn't even see the night sky because of the overcast. I was tired and hungry and strangely out of sorts. Being single can be confusing. On the one hand, you sometimes yearn for the simple comfort of companionship, someone to discuss your day with, someone with whom you can celebrate a raise or tax refund, someone who will commiserate when you're down with a cold. On the other hand, once you get used to being alone, in other words, having everything your way, you have to wonder why you'd ever take on the aggravation of a relationship. Other human beings have all these hotly held opinions, habits and mannerisms, bad art and peculiar taste in music, not to mention mood disorders, food preferences, passions, hobbies, allergies, emotional fixations, and attitudes that in no way coincide with the correct ones, namely yours. Not that I was thinking seriously of Robert Dietz in this way, but I'd noticed, walking into the apartment, an unnerving awareness of the otherness of him. It's not that he was intrusive, obnoxious, or untidy. He was just there, and his presence acted on me like an irritant. I mean, where was this going? Nowhere that I could tell. I'd no more than get used to him than he'd hit the road again. So why bother to adjust when his company wasn't permanent? Personally, I don't consider flexibility that desirable a trait. I heard a key turn in the lock, and I realized with a start I drifted off to sleep. I sat up, blinking fuzzily. Below me, Dietz was turning on additional lights. I could hear the crackle of paper. I got up and moved over to the railing, looking down at him. He turned on the radio. I put my fingers in my ears so I wouldn't have to listen to Elvis sing soulfully about love. Who needs that shit? Dietz was a big country music fan, and I was hoping he'd flip the station to find something more twangy and a lot less to the point. He sensed my presence and tilted his face in my direction.
Good, you're home. I didn't see your car outside, he said. I picked up some groceries. You want to help me unload?
I'll be there in a minute. I made a quick detour to the bathroom, where I ran a comb through my hair, brushed my teeth, and availed myself of the facilities. I'd forgotten how domesticated Dietz could be. When I thought about the man, it was his personal security expertise that came foremost to mind. I padded down the stairs in my sock feet.
How'd you know what we needed?
I checked. Surprise, surprise, the cupboards were bare.
He had the refrigerator open, placing eggs, bacon, butter, lunch meats, and various other high-fat, high-cholesterol items in the bins. On the counter was a six-pack of beer, 2 bottles of Chardonnay, extra-crunchy peanut butter, canned goods and assorted condiments, along with a loaf of bread. He'd even remembered paper napkins, paper towels, toilet paper, and liquid detergent. I put the canned goods in the cabinet and turned off the radio. If Dietz noticed, he said nothing. Over his shoulder, he said,
How'd the interview go?
I said, Fine. I haven't made a lick of progress, but you have to start someplace.
What's the next move?
I'm having Darcy run a DMV check through the insurance company I used to work for. She hopes to have something early tomorrow morning. Then we'll see what's what. I have other lines of pursuit, but she's my best bet so far.
You're not working for California Fidelity these days?
Actually, I'm not. I got my ass fired because I wouldn't kiss someone else's. I rent an office in a law firm. It works out better that way. I could see him toy with other questions,
but he must have decided that the less said the better. He changed the subject.
Can I talk you into eating out?
What did you have in mind?
Something in walking distance where we don't have to dress.
I looked at him for a moment, feeling strangely unwilling to cooperate.
How's the old friend?
Deet suppressed a smile.
He's fine. Is that what's bothering you?
No. I don't know. I think I've been depressed for weeks and just now got in touch with it. I'm also nervous about the job. I'm working for my cousin Tasha, which I probably shouldn't be doing.
A cousin? That's a new one. Where did she come from?
God, you are out of date.
Grab a jacket and let's go. You can talk about it over dinner and bring me up to speed.
We walked from my apartment to a restaurant on the breakwater, 3 long blocks during which little was said. The night was very chilly, and the lights strung out along the harbor were like leftover Christmas decorations. Over the softly tumbling surf, I could hear the tinkle of a buoy, the tinny sound mixing with the gentle lapping of water against the boats in the marina. Many vessels were alight, and the occasional glimpses of the liveaboards reminded me of a trailer park, a community of small spaces, looking cozy from outside. Dietz's pace was rapid. He had his head bent, his hands in his pockets, heels clicking on the pavement. I kept up with him, my mind running back over what I knew of him. His upbringing had been a strange one. He told me he was born in a van on the road outside Detroit. His mother was in labor, and his father was too impatient to find an emergency room. His father was a brawler and a bully who worked the oil rigs, moving his family from one town to the next as the mood struck. Dietz's granny, his mother's mother, traveled with them in the vehicle of the moment, a truck, a van, or a station wagon, all second-hand and subject to breakdown or quick sale if the money ran low. Dietz had been educated out of an assortment of old textbooks while his mother and granny drank beers and threw the cans out the window onto the highway. His dislike of formal schooling was an attribute we shared. Because he'd had so little experience with institutions, he was fiercely insubordinate. He didn't so much go against regulations as ignore them, operating on the assumption that the rules simply didn't apply to him. I liked his rebelliousness. At the same time, I was wary. I was into caution and control. He was into anarchy. We reached the restaurant, the Tramp Steamer, a cramped and overheated gray-frame establishment located up a narrow flight of wooden stairs. A modest effort had been made to give the place a nautical feel, but its real attraction was the fare: raw oysters, fried shrimp, peppery chowder, and homemade bread. There was a full bar near the entrance, but most of the clientele preferred beer. The air was saturated with the smell of hops and cigarette smoke. Between the honky-tonk jukebox, the raucous laughter and conversations, the noise was palpable. Deet scanned the room for seating, then pushed through a side door and found us a table on the deck overlooking the marina. Outside it was quieter, and the chill air was offset by the red glow of wall-mounted propane heaters. The briny scent of the ocean seemed stronger up here than it had down below. I took a deep breath, sucking it into my lungs like ether. It had the same sedative effect, and I could feel myself unwind.
"You want Chardonnay?" he asked.
"I'd love it."
I sat at the table while he moved back inside to the bar. I watched him through the window in conversation with the bartender. As he waited for the order, his gaze moved restlessly across the crowd. He crossed to the jukebox and studied the selections. Dietz was the sort of man who paced and tapped his fingers, subterranean energy constantly bubbling to the surface. I seldom saw him read a book because he couldn't sit still that long. When he did read, he was out of commission, utterly absorbed until he was finished. He liked competition. He liked guns. He liked machines. He liked tools. He liked climbing rocks. His basic attitude was, "What are you saving yourself for?" My basic attitude was, "Let's not jump right into things." Dietz wandered back to the bar and stood there jiggling the change in his pocket. The bartender set a mug of beer and a glass of wine on the counter. Dietz pulled off some bills and returned to the deck, trailing the smell of cigarette smoke like a strange aftershave. He said,
"Service is slow. I hope the food's good."
We touched glasses before we drank, though I wasn't sure what we were drinking to. I opened a menu and let my eyes trace the choices. I wasn't really that hungry. Maybe a salad or soup. I usually don't eat much at night.
I called the boys, he remarked.
And how are they? I asked. I'd never met his two sons, but he spoke of them with affection.
They're fine. The boys are great, he said. Nick turns 21 on the 14th. He's a senior at Santa Cruz, but he just changed his major, so he'll probably be there another year. Graham's 19 and a sophomore. They're sharing an apartment with a bunch of guys this year. They're smart kids. They like school and seem to be motivated, more than I ever was. Naomi's done a good job without a lot of help from me. I support him, but I can't say I ever spent much time on the scene. I feel bad about that, but you know how I am. I'm a rolling stone, I can't help it. I could never settle down and buy a house and work 9 to 5. I can't behave myself in a situation like that.
Where's Naomi?
San Francisco. She got a law degree. I paid her tuition. I'm good about that end, but all the hard work was hers. The boys say she's getting married to some attorney up there.
Good for her.
How about you? What have you been up to?
Not a lot. Mostly work. I don't take vacations, so I haven't been anywhere that didn't somehow involve a stakeout or a background check.
I'm a bundle of laughs. You should learn how to play.
I should learn how to do a lot of things.
The waitress approached, moving toward us from a table in the angle of the deck.
You two ready to order?
She was probably in her late 20s, a honey blonde with her hair in a boy cut and braces on her teeth. She wore matching black shorts and tank top, as if it were August instead of January 8th.
Give us a minute,
Deet said. We ended up splitting a big bowl of steamed mussels nestled in a spicy tomato broth. For entrees, Dietz had a rare steak and I had a Caesar salad. We both ate as though we were racing against the clock. We used to make love the same way, like some contest to see who could get there first.
Tell me about the Depression,
he said when he had pushed his plate aside. I gestured dismissively. Forget it. I don't like to sit around feeling sorry for myself.
Go ahead. You're allowed.
I know I'm allowed, but what's the point? I said. I can't even tell you what it's about. Maybe my serotonin levels are off.
No doubt, but what's the rest of it?
The usual, I guess. I mean, some days I don't get it. What we're doing on the planet. I read the paper and it's hopeless. Poverty and disease. All the bullshit from politicians who'd tell you anything to get elected. Then you have the hole in the ozone and the destruction of the rainforests. What am I supposed to do with this stuff? I know it's not up to me to solve the world's problems, but I'd like to believe there's a hidden order somewhere.
Good luck.
Yeah, good luck. Anyway, I'm struggling for answers. Most of the time I take life for granted. I do what I do and it seems to make sense. Once in a while I lose track of where I fit. I know it sounds lame, but it's the truth.
What makes you think there are any answers? He said. You do the best you can.
Whatever that consists of, I remarked.
Therein lies the rub,
he smiled.
What about the job? What scares you about that?
I always get amped on the eve of a big one. One of these days I'm going to fail, and I don't like the thought. It's stage fright.
Where'd the cousin come from? I thought you didn't have any family.
Don't I wish, I said. Turns out I have a bunch of cousins up in Lompoc, all girls. I'd prefer not to have anything to do with them, but they keep popping up. I'm too old to cope with togetherness.
Such a liar,
he said fondly, but he let it pass. The waitress came by. We declined dessert and coffee. Dietz asked for the check, which she produced from a sheaf tucked in the small of her back, taking a few seconds to total it out. Her yellow socks and black high tops really gave the outfit some class. She placed the bill face down on the table, slightly closer to Dietz's side than to mine. This was probably her tactic for playing it safe in case we were a twosome whose roles were reversed. She said, I can take that any time you want. She moved off to deliver ketchup to another table. She must have the metabolism of a bird. The cold wasn't even producing goosebumps. Dietz glanced at the check briefly, recalculating the total in the blink of an eye. He leaned sideways to extract his wallet and pulled out a pair of bills that he slid under his plate.
Ready?
Whenever you are. We took the long way home. It seemed easier talking in the dark without looking at each other. The conversation was superficial. I'm an expert at using words to keep other people at bay. When we got home, I made sure Dietz had everything he needed. Sheets, two pillows, an extra blanket, a small alarm clock, and a fresh towel. All of life's little amenities, except me. I left him below and headed up the spiral stairs. When I got to the top, I leaned over the rail. With your bum knee, I take it you won't be jogging with me in the morning.
Afraid not. I'm sorry. It's something I miss.
I'll try not to wake you. Thanks for dinner.
You're welcome. Sleep well.
Use your ice pack.
Yes, ma'am.
As it turned out, I slept a lot sooner than he did. Dietz was a night owl. I'm not sure how he occupied himself. Maybe he polished his boots or cleaned his handgun. He might have watched late-night television with the sound turned down. I sure never heard him. Once in a while, in turning over, I realized the light was still on in the living room. There was something so parental about his being on the premises. One thing about being single, you don't often feel protected. You tend to sleep with your mental shoes on, ready to leap up and arm yourself at the least little noise. With Dietz on guard duty, I got to cruise through a couple of rounds of REM, dreaming right up to the split second before the alarm went off. I opened my eyes, reached out, and caught it just before it blared. I did my morning ablutions behind closed doors so the sound of running water wouldn't carry. Shoes in hand, I crept down the stairs in my stocking feet and tiptoed out the front door without waking him. I laced up, did a quick stretch, and set off at a fast walk to get warmed up. The night had shifted from pitch black to charcoal gray, and by the time I reached Cabana, the darkness was beginning to lift. Dawn painted the early morning sky in pale watercolor hues. The ocean was silver blue, the sky washing up from a smoky mauve to soft peach. The oil derricks dotted the horizon like clusters of iridescent sequins. I loved the sound of the surf at that hour, the squawk of seagulls, the soft cooing of the pigeons already strutting along the path. A platinum blonde and a black standard poodle were heading in my direction, a pair I saw most of the mornings I was out. The run was good. Often 3 miles just feels like a pain in the ass, something I do because I know I must. For once, here I was feeling grateful to be physically fit. I wouldn't do well with an injury like Dietz's that prevented exercise. I'll never be any kind of champ, but for lifting a depression, there's really nothing better. I did the turn at East Beach and started back, picking up my pace a bit. The sun was coming up behind me, sloshing rivulets of yellow light across the sky. Walking home again, winded and sweating, my mood was light and I was feeling good. Dietz was in the shower when I got in. He'd brought in the paper and set it on the kitchen counter. He'd tidied the bed covers and folded up the sofa bed, tucking the pillows out of sight somewhere. I put on a pot of coffee and then went upstairs, waiting until I heard him turn off his shower before I started mine. By 8:35, I was dressed. I'd finished breakfast, and I was gathering up my jacket and my car keys. Dietz was still sitting at the kitchen counter with his second cup of coffee and the morning paper spread out before him. See you later, I said.
Have a good one, he replied.
On the way downtown, I stopped off at a nearby condominium with the two subpoenas in hand. I served both without incident, though the fellow and his girlfriend were hardly happy with me. Occasionally, I'll have someone who goes to absurd lengths to avoid service. But for the most part, people seem resigned to their fates. If someone protests or turns ugly, my response is usually the same. Sorry, pal, but I'm like a waitress. I don't cook up the trouble, I just serve it. Have a nice day, I say. For a change, I parked in the public lot across from the courthouse and walked the 2 blocks to work. My current office is the former conference room for the law firm of Kingman and Ives, located in downtown Santa Teresa. From my apartment, the drive takes about 10 minutes, given the usual traffic conditions.
The Kingman Building appears to be a three-story stucco structure, but the ground floor is an illusion. Behind a fieldstone facade, complete with barred and shuttered windows, there's actually a small parking lot with 12 assigned spaces. Most of the office staff and the lesser tenants in the building are forced to scrounge parking elsewhere. The surrounding blocks aren't metered, but parking is restricted to 90 minutes max, and most of us receive at least one ticket a month. Some mornings it's comical watching us pass and repass, trying to beat one another to the available spaces. I climb the two flights of stairs, foregoing the pleasures of the elevator, which is small and takes forever, often giving the impression it's on the verge of getting stuck. Once in the office, I exchanged pleasantries with the receptionist, Allison, and Lonnie Kingman's secretary, Ida Ruth. I seldom see Lonnie, who's either in court or working doggedly behind closed doors. I let myself into my office, where I pause to make a note of the date, time, and a brief physical description of the couple to whom I'd served the subpoenas. I typed up a quick invoice, then picked up the telephone, leaning back in my swivel chair as I tossed the paperwork in my outbox. California Fidelity didn't open until 9, but Darcy usually came in early. "Hey, Darcy, it's me," I said when she answered on her end. "Oh, hi, Kinsey. Hang on a minute, I'm not at my desk." She put me on hold, and I listened to leftover Christmas carols while I waited, feeling mildly optimistic. I figured if she hadn't found anything, she'd have said so. Half a minute passed, and then she clicked back in. "Okay. Guy David Malik doesn't have a current driver's license in the state of California. His was surrendered in 1968, and apparently it's never been reissued." "Well, shit," I said. Darcy laughed. "Would you just wait? You're always jumping to conclusions. All I said was he doesn't drive. He has a California identification card, which is where I picked up the information. His mailing address is Route 1, Box 600, Marcella, California, 93456. That's probably the same as his residence. Sounds like a ranch or a farm. You want to see the picture?" "You have a current picture of him? This is great. I don't believe it. You're a wizard." "Hey, you're dealing with a pro," she said. "What's your fax number?" I gave her Lonnie's fax number while I reached for the telephone book. "Are you sure he's in Marcella? That's less than 100 miles away." "According to DMV records." "That should make your job easy." "Ain't that the truth? What do I owe you?" "Don't worry about it. I had to fake out some forms to make the request look legitimate, but nobody's going to check." Took less than a minute. "You're a doll. Thanks so much. I'll be in touch and we'll have lunch. I'll pay." Darcy laughed. "I'll take you up on that." I put the phone down and paged through the telephone book, looking up the area code for Marcella, California. It was actually in the 805 area, the same as Santa Teresa. I tried directory assistance, giving the operator Guy Malik's name. There was no telephone listed at the address I'd been given. "You have any other listing for Guy Malik in the area? G. Malik? Any kind of Malik?" "No, ma'am." "All right, thanks." I trotted down the hall to the fax machine just in time to see a copy of Guy Malik's photo ID slide out. The black-and-white reproduction had a splotchy quality, but it did establish Guy David Malik's sex, M, hair, blonde, eyes, green, height, 5'8", weight, 155, DOB, 3242. He looked ever so much better than he had in his high school annual. 3 cheers for him. I confess I felt smug as I sat down at my desk, the little show-off in my nature patting herself on the back. I called Tasha's office and identified myself to her secretary when she picked up. She said, "Tosh is in a meeting, but let me tell her it's you. She can probably take a quick call if it's important."
"Trust me, it is."
"Can you hold?"
"Sure."
While I waited, I laid out a hand of solitaire. 1 card up and 6 cards down. In some ways, I was sorry everything had come together so fast. I didn't want Donovan to think he was paying for something he could have done himself. Though, in truth, he was. There's a lot of information available as a matter of public record. Most people simply don't have the time or the interest in doing the grunt work. They're all too happy to have a PI do it for them. So in the end, everybody benefits. Still, this one was almost too easy, especially since I wasn't sure the family would believe their real interests had been served by my discovery. I turned the next card up on the second pile and placed another 5 cards down. Tasha clicked on, sounding terse and distracted. "Hi, Kinsey, what's up? I hope this is important because I'm up to my ass in work. I have an address for Guy Malik. I thought I'd better let you know first thing." There was half a second silence while she processed the information.
"That was fast. How'd you manage?"
I smiled at her tone, which was the perfect blend of surprise and respect. "I have my little ways," I said. Ah, how seductive the satisfaction when we think we've impressed others with our cleverness. It's one of the perversities of human nature that we're more interested in the admiration of our enemies than the approbation of our friends. "You have a pencil?"
"Of course. Where's he living?"
"Not far." I gave her the address. "There's no telephone listed. Either he doesn't have phone service or it's in someone else's name."
"Amazing," she said.
"Let me pass this along to Donovan and see what he wants to do next. He'll be delighted, I'm sure."
I doubt that. I got the impression they'd all be happier if Guy turned up dead.
"Nonsense. This is family. I'm sure things will work out. I'll have him give you a call."
Within 15 minutes, my phone rang. Donovan Malik was on the line.
"Nice work," he said. "I'm surprised how quick it was. I thought the search would take weeks."
"It's not always this easy. We got lucky," I said. "You need anything else?"
"Tasha and I just had a chat about that. I suggested we have you go up there in person. She could contact him by letter, but people sometimes react oddly getting mail from an attorney. You feel threatened before you even open the envelope. We don't want to set the wrong tone."
"Sure, I can talk to him," I said, feeling puzzled what the right tone would be.
"I'd like a first-hand report about Guy's current circumstances. Are you free sometime in the next 2 days?"
I checked my calendar.
"I can go this afternoon if you like."
"The sooner the better. I want this handled with kid gloves. I have no idea if he's heard about Dad's death, but even with the estrangement, he could be upset. Besides, the money's a touchy issue. Who knows how he'll react?"
"You want me to tell him about the will?"
"I don't see why not. He's bound to find out eventually."
Chapter 5. I glanced at my watch. Since there was nothing on my schedule, I thought I might as well hit the road. It was just now 9:30. A round trip to Marcella would take a little more than an hour each way. If I allowed myself an hour to track down Guy Malik, I'd still have plenty of time left to grab a quick lunch and be back mid-afternoon.
I opened my bottom desk drawer and took out my map of California. According to the legend, Marcella was maybe 80 miles north, with a population of less than 1,500 souls. I didn't think it would take even an hour to locate him once I hit town, assuming he was still there. The conversation itself probably wouldn't take more than 30 minutes, which meant I might get this whole job wrapped up by the end of the day. I put a call through to Dietz and let him know what was going on. I could hear the television in the background, one of those perpetual news broadcasts riddled with commercials. At the end of the hour, you know more about dog food than you do about world events. Dietz indicated he had no particular plans. I wasn't sure if he was angling for an invitation to accompany me, but since he didn't ask the question, I didn't answer it. I didn't want to feel responsible for his entertainment anyway. I told him I expected to be back by 3 and would bypass the office and come straight home. We could figure out what to do about dinner when I finally rolled in. I gassed up my VW and headed north on 101. The sunshine was short-lived. Where the highway hugged the coastline, the fog had rolled in and the sky was now milky white with clouds turning thick at the edge. Along the road, the evergreens stood out against the horizon in a variety of dark shapes. Traffic moved steadily, mostly single-passenger cars with an occasional horse van, probably heading to the Santa Ynez Valley just north of us. We hadn't had much rain, and the hills looked like dull, hay-colored mounds, with an occasional oil rig genuflecting in a series of obsequious bows toward the earth.
The road turned inland, and within the hour the clouds had burned off again, fading back into a sky of pale blue, streaked with a residual haze as wispy as goose down. Just outside Santa Maria, I took 166 East and drove for 10 miles on the two-lane road that paralleled the Cayama River. The heat from the January sun was thin up here. Through the valleys and canyons, the earth smelled dry and a string of bald brown hills rose up in front of me. Rain had been promised, but the weather seemed to flirt, teasing us with high clouds and a hint of a breeze. The town of Marcela was situated in the shadow of the Los Coches Mountain. Driving, I was aware of the unseen presence of the great San Andreas Fault, the 750-mile fracture that snakes up the California coastline from the Mexican border to the triple junction near Mendocino, the Pacific and North American plates grinding against each other since time began. Under the thin layers of granite and marine sediment, the crust of the earth was as cracked as a skull. In this area, the San Andreas Fault was intersected by the Santa Ynez Fault, with the White Wolf and the Garlock not far away. It's speculated that the mountains in this part of the state once ran north-south, like other mountains along the coast. According to theory, the southern tip of this chain was snagged by the Pacific Plate millions of years ago and dragged sideways as it passed, thus shifting the range to its current east-west orientation. I'd been driving my car once during a minor quake, and it felt like the VW had suddenly been passed by a fast-moving 18-wheeler. There was a lurch to the right, as if the car had been sucked into a sudden vacuum. In California, where the weather seems to change so little, we look to earthquakes for the drama that tornadoes and hurricanes provide elsewhere. At the junction of two roads, I caught sight of a discreet sign and turned southward into the town of Marcela. The streets were 6 lanes wide and sparsely traveled. An occasional palm or juniper had been planted near the curb. There were no buildings over 2 stories high, and the structures I saw consisted of a general store with iron bars across the front windows, a hotel, 3 motels, a real estate office, and a large Victorian house surrounded by scaffolding. The only bar was located in a building that looked like it might have been a post office once, stripped now of any official function. A Budweiser sign was hanging in a window. What did the citizens of Marcela do for a living, and why settle here? There wasn't another town for miles, and the business in this one seemed weighted toward drinking beer and going to bed soon afterward. If you wanted fast food or auto parts, if you needed a prescription filled, a movie, a fitness center, or a wedding gown, you'd have to drive into Santa Maria, or farther north on 101 to Atascadero and Paso Robles. The land surrounding the town seemed barren. I hadn't seen anything that even halfway resembled a citrus orchard or a plowed field. Maybe the countryside was devoted to ranches or mines or stock car races. Maybe people lived here to escape the hurly-burly of San Luis Obispo. I found a gas station on a side street and stopped for directions. The youth who emerged was about 17. He was skinny, had pale eyes, hair shaved very close up to his ears, and a tangle of teeth, all reminiscent of someone in an early episode of The Twilight Zone. I said, "Hi, I'm looking for a friend of mine named Guy Malik. I think he lives on Route 1 somewhere, but he didn't give me directions." Well, okay, I was fudging, but I didn't outright lie. I would be Guy's friend when he heard the news about the $5 million. The youth said nothing, but he pointed a trembling finger like the ghost of Christmas past. I glanced over my shoulder. "Back that way?" "That's the house." I turned to stare with astonishment. The property was enclosed by chain-link fencing. Beyond a rolling chicken-wire gate, I could see a small house, a shed, a large barn with corrugated metal siding curling away from the seams, an old yellow school bus, a single gas pump, and a sign too faded to read at any distance. The gate was open. "Oh, well, thanks. Do you know if he's home?" "No." "He's not?" "No, I don't know. I didn't see him today." "Ah, well, I guess I'll go knock." "You could do that," he said. I pulled out of the station and drove across the road. I nosed the VW through the open gate and parked on a length of raw dirt that I took for a driveway.
I got out. The surface of the yard was white sand with a rim of brown grass around the edge. The house was frame, painted once upon a time white, one story with a wooden porch built across the front. A trellis that shielded the windows on the left sported only one bare vine, which twisted through the latticework like a boa constrictor. A matching trellis on the right had collapsed under its burden of dry, brown vegetation. Various wires extended from the roofline, connecting the occupants to telephone, cable, and electricity. I climbed the wooden stairs and knocked on the dilapidated screen. The front door was shut, and there were no signs of life. There was a fine dusting of soot everywhere, as if the structure were downwind of a smelting plant. The porch floor began to tremble in a way that suggested that someone was traversing the wooden floor inside of the house. The door was opened, and I found myself face to face with the man I took to be Guy Malik. Aside from a 3-day growth of beard, he didn't look anywhere near his age. His hair looked darker and straighter than it had in his high school yearbook, but his features were still boyish. Khaki green eyes fringed with dark lashes, a small straight nose, and a generous mouth. His complexion was clear, and his color was good. Age had sketched in fine lines around his eyes, and the flesh along his jaw was beginning to sag, but I'd have pegged him in his mid-30s. At 50 and 60, he'd no doubt look just the same, the years making only moderate adjustments to his good looks. He wore denim overalls on top of what looked like a union suit. He was in the process of putting on a blue jeans jacket when he answered the door, and he paused to straighten the collar in the back before he said,
"Hey."
As an adolescent, Guy Malik had been as dorky-looking as the rest of us. He was the bad kid, lawless and self-destructive, one of life's lost souls. He must have been appealing because he was so in need of rescue. Women can't resist a man who needs saving. Now his good angel had apparently taken up residence, bestowing on his countenance the look of serenity. It seemed odd that his brothers had matured so differently. Already I liked this man better than his siblings. Aside from the scruffiness, he didn't look like he was snorting, sniffing, or mainlining illegal substances. "Are you Guy Malik?" His smile was hesitant, as though I might be someone he had met before whose name he wished he remembered.
"Yes."
"My name is Kinsey Milhone. I'm a private investigator from Santa Teresa." I gave him a business card. He studied the card but didn't offer to shake hands. His were as soiled as an auto mechanic's. I could see a muscle work in his jaw. His eyes came up to mine, and his entire body became still. The smile faded.
"My family hired you?"
"Well, yes," I said. I was about to launch into a diplomatic account of his father's death when I saw tears rise in his eyes, blurring the clear green of his gaze. He looked upward, blinking, and took a deep breath before he brought his attention back to mine. He dashed at his cheeks, laughing with embarrassment. He said,
"Whoa,"
pinching at his eyes with the fingers of one hand. He shook his head, trying to compose himself.
"Sorry, you caught me by surprise. I never thought it would matter, but I guess it does. I always wished they'd send someone, but I'd about given up hope. How'd you find me?"
"It wasn't that hard. I ran a DMV check and came up with your California identification card. I tried directory assistance, but they didn't have you listed. I take it you don't have a phone."
"Can't afford one," he said. "You want to come in?"
His manner was awkward, and he seemed unsure of himself. His gaze fell away from mine and then came back again. "I'd like that," I said. He stepped back to allow me entrance, and I passed into a room that was about what you'd expect. The interior construction was crude and featured wide, unfinished floorboards and windows that didn't quite shut. Various pieces of old furniture had been moved into the space, probably cadged from the city dump, if there was one in this town. Every surface was piled high with soiled clothes, and books and magazines and utensils, pots and pans and canned goods and tools. There were also what looked like farm implements whose functions were unclear. There was a tower of used tires in one corner of the room, and a toilet that didn't seem connected to much of anything. Guy caught my puzzlement.
I'm holding that for a fellow. I have a real bathroom in there, he said, smiling shyly.
Glad to hear that, I said, and smiled back at him.
You want a cup of coffee? It's instant, but it's not bad.
No, thanks. Were you on your way out?
What? Oh, yeah, but don't worry about that. I have to be someplace shortly. Have a seat.
He pulled out a handkerchief and paused to blow his nose. I could feel anxiety stir in my chest. There was something touching about his openness. He gestured toward a frayed, lumpy couch with a spring sticking through the cushion. I perched on the edge, hoping not to do serious damage to my private parts. My discomfort was related to the fact that Guy Malik apparently thought his family had hired me to conduct the search out of sentiment. I knew their real attitude, which was actually hostile if the truth be known. I did a quick debate with myself and decided I'd better level with him. Whatever the outcome of our conversation, it would be too humiliating for him if I let him harbor the wrong impression. He pulled up a wooden chair and sat facing me directly, occasionally mopping at his eyes. He didn't apologize for the tears that continued to spill down his cheeks.
You don't know how hard I prayed for this, he said, mouth trembling.
He looked down at his hands and began to fold the handkerchief in on itself.
The pastor of my church, he swore up and down it would come to pass if it was meant to be. No point in praying if it isn't God's will, he said. And I kept saying, man, it seems like they'd have found me by now if they cared enough, you know?
I was struck by the fact that his circumstances were oddly reminiscent of mine, both of us trying to assimilate fractured family connections. At least he welcomed his, though he'd misunderstood the purpose of my visit. I felt like a dog having to set him straight. Guy, as a matter of fact, it's more complicated. I have some bad news, I said.
My father died?
2 weeks ago. I'm not sure of the date. I gather he'd had a stroke and he was also struggling with cancer. He'd been through a lot, and I guess his body just gave up on him. He was silent for a moment, staring off into space.
Well, I guess I'm not surprised, he said. Do you know if he was the one who asked for me?
I have no idea. I wasn't hired until yesterday. The probate attorney is getting the process underway. By law, you're required to be notified since you're one of the beneficiaries. He turned to me, suddenly getting it.
Ah, you're here on official business and that's all it is, right?
More or less. I watched as the color rose slowly in his cheeks.
Silly me, he said. And here I thought you were sent by someone who actually gave a shit.
I'm sorry.
Not your fault, he said. What else?
What else?
I'm wondering if you have any other news to impart.
Not really. If he'd picked up on the fact that he was due to inherit money, he gave no indication.
I don't suppose there's any chance my father asked for me.
I wish I could help, but I wasn't given any details. It's possible, I'm sure, but you may never know. You can ask the attorney when you talk to her. She knows a lot more than I do about the circumstances of his death. He smiled fleetingly.
Dad hired a woman? That doesn't sound like him.
Donovan hired her. She went to school with his wife.
What about Bennett and Jack? Are they married?
He said the names as if the sounds hadn't been uttered for years. No, just Donovan. I don't think he and Christy have any kids as yet. He runs the company, which I understand is now the third largest construction firm in the state.
Good for him. Donnie was always obsessed with the business, he said. Did you talk to the other two?
Briefly. The character of his expression had completely changed as we spoke. What had started out as happiness had shifted to painful enlightenment.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I get the impression they're not really interested in me. The attorney said they had to do this, so they're doing it, is that it? I mean, the three of them aren't burdened by a lot of warm, gooey feelings where I'm concerned.
That's true, but it probably stems from the situation when you left. I was told you were in a lot of trouble, so their memories of you aren't that flattering.
I suppose not, nor mine of them if it comes right down to it.
Besides, nobody really believed I'd find you.
It's been, what,
18 years?
About that. Not long enough, apparently, from their perspective.
Where'd you go when you left? Do you mind if I ask?
Why would I mind? It doesn't amount to much. I went out to the highway to hitch a ride. I was heading for San Francisco, zonked out of my head on acid. The fellow who picked me up was a preacher who'd been hired by a church about a mile from here. He took me in. I was tripped out so bad I didn't even know where I was at.
And you've been here all this time?
Not quite, he said. It wasn't like I cleaned up and got straight just like that. I screwed up more than once. I'd backslide, you know, get drunk and take off. But Pete and his wife always found me and brought me back. Finally, I realized I wasn't going to shake them off. Didn't matter what I did, they were sticking to me like glue. That's when I took a stand and found Jesus in my heart. It really turned my life around.
And you never got in touch with your family? I said. He shook his head, his smile bitter.
They haven't exactly been clamoring for me either.
Maybe that will change when I talk to them. What else can I tell them? Do you work?
Sure I work. I do maintenance at the church and, you know, general handyman jobs around town. Painting and repairs, plumbing, electrical. About anything you need. Mostly minimum wage, but I'm the only one who does it, so I stay busy.
Sounds like you've done all right for yourself. He looked around him.
Well, I don't have much, but I don't need much either. Place isn't mine, he said. The church provides my housing, but I make enough to take care of the basics. Food and utilities, that sort of thing. I don't drive, but I have a bike, and that gets me most places in a town this size.
You've changed quite a lot.
I'd be dead otherwise.
He glanced at his watch.
Listen, I don't mean to rush you, but I probably ought to get myself on over to the church.
I won't keep you then. I appreciate your time. Can I give you a lift?
Sure. We can talk on the way.
Once in the car, he directed me back to the highway. We turned right onto 166, heading east again. We drove for a while in companionable silence. He slid a look in my direction.
So, what's your assignment? Find me and report back?
That's about it, I said. Now that we have a current address, Tasha Howard, the attorney, will be sending you notice of the probate.
Oh, that's right. I forgot. I'm a beneficiary, you said.
His tone had turned light and nearly mocking.
That doesn't interest you? Not particularly. I thought I needed something from those people, but as it turns out, I don't.
He pointed at an upcoming junction, and I took a right-hand turn onto a small side road. The roadbed had been downgraded from blacktop to loose gravel, and I could see the plumes of white dust swirling up in my rear window as we drove. The church was situated at the edge of a pasture about a half mile down. The sign said, Jubilee Evangelical Church.
You can pull up right here, he said. You want to come in and see the place? If you're paid by the hour, you might as well have the full tour. I'm sure Donnie can afford it.
I hesitated slightly. All right. He cocked his head.
You don't have to worry. I won't try to convert you.
I parked and the two of us got out. He didn't issue a proclamation, but I could tell from his manner that he was proud of the place. He took out a ring of keys and let us in. The church was small, a frame building, little more than one room. There was something about its plain appearance that spoke of goodness. The stained glass windows were not elaborate. Each was divided into six simple panels of pale gold with a scripture written across the bottom. There was an unadorned wood pulpit at the front, positioned to the left of a raised and carpeted platform. On the right, there was an organ and three rows of folding chairs for the choir. Last Sunday's flowers consisted of a spray of white gladiola.
Place was destroyed by fire about 10 years back. Congregation rebuilt everything from the ground right on up.
I said, How'd you get on track? That must have been hard. He sat down in one of the front pews, and I could see him look around, perhaps seeing the place as I saw it.
I give credit to the Lord. Though Pete always says I did the work myself, he said. I grew up without much guidance, without values of any kind. I'm not blaming anybody, that's just how it was. My parents were good people. They didn't drink or beat me or anything like that, but they never talked about God, or faith, or their religious beliefs, assuming they had any, which I don't guess they did. My brothers and I, even when we were little kids, never went to Sunday school or church. My parents disliked organized religion. I don't know what that phrase meant to them or what their perception was, but they took pride in making sure none